Hi, I'm Lyndon Saunders. Welcome to Feeling Good About Yourself, an in-depth exploration. To feel good about yourself, you need to feel a sense of welcome. You need to feel at home. And as we go through these 12 explorations, I hope you'll have a sense of security and well-being. And at the same time you're experiencing welcome, I hope you'll experience wonder, the wonder that comes from exploring the possibilities for your life. Exploration isn't always comfortable, but if we travel light and keep a balance of welcome and wonder, we'll find out what it'll take for us to be happy. And now we're ready for exploration number one, why your problems won't go away. How can you feel good about yourself if you've got problems that won't go away? Our problems began when we were children. I remember the time I ripped my pants at school, nearly died of embarrassment. And that's when I first knew there was something wrong with the world. And from there, the problems became more complex. In your teen years, haunted by the possibility of rejection, being left out, it was often tough to fit in. It was tough to be accepted, and once you were accepted, it was tough to stay accepted, and you began to walk a thin line. The dread of poor performance hung heavy over you. Maybe poor grades, social pressure, criticism at home, problems. Not getting the girl or boy you wanted, the showdown with the bully, and you lost. Your bank account was overdrawn. The car broke down, and right at the worst time. Company was coming, the air conditioner at home went on the blink, your commode ran over, your kid broke his arm. You look in the mirror, you're losing your hair. And at the same time, gaining a waistline. Your teeth need filling, your eyesight is dimming, you lose a marriage, you lose a job. The doctor says, you've got a serious disease. You get depressed, lonely. You're insecure and you worry a lot. You feel your life isn't succeeding as you'd hoped it would. And your days begin to run together as time flies away, and all too soon it dawns on you, you're growing old, and a sense of emptiness begins to take over. You get to feeling bad about yourself. You feel bad because you begin to sense failure in your life. Now, it didn't happen all at once. Little by little, the problems kept piling up, kept thinking all of this will pass just around the next corner, just over the next hill. I'll win. I'll conquer this failure. I'll finally become the person I was meant to be, and it'll be smooth sailing from there on. But the longer you went, the greater the problems became. Each year brought its new set of problems, and soon it was harder for you to convince yourself things were going to get better. You began to settle for less, to compromise your high expectations for yourself. It became more difficult for you to love yourself. Your life became quieter inside, but not the quiet that comes from peace and fulfillment, from feeling good about yourself, no, but more the quiet that settles in as a result of desperation or from being overcome with a sense of futility. A strange thing happens to us as we try to deal with failure in our lives. I think we begin with a sort of a denial of failure. We don't quite feel right about admitting it when it comes to us. We find explanations for why things went wrong and why we haven't been able to make them go right. We point the finger of blame at others. We begin to suffer from the victim mentality. We got the bad breaks. The stars were against us. We ran out of luck. We build our defenses, and our defenses begin to separate us from ourselves as they grow bigger and bigger, and we feel torn inside and disappointed, sad, angry. So often it never occurred to us that failure wasn't some alien act that slipped quite by accident into our lives, but rather failure is inherent to human life. It's there. It will always be there. You've never conquered it because it cannot be conquered. You've never defeated it because it wasn't defeatable. You've tackled it, though, as if you would overcome it, put it behind you, and live without it. But is that realistic? Has anyone ever defeated failure in a lifetime? Oh, you can overcome specific instances, but I'm talking not about specific failures, but the presence of failure in human life generally. Failure is there. Failure is human. It's as much a part of you as your hair, your nose, and your eyes. It is not inhuman to fail. It is inhuman to deny failure. And as long as you think you'll get rid of failure in your life, you'll never find the answer to failure. You see, the problem of your life isn't failure. It's the way you're dealing with failure. Failure can be faced and dealt with successfully. Failure will never keep you from being fulfilled as a person. You can do that with lots of failure if you understand it. Not to understand it, now that's failure, and disastrous failure. It's fatal. To fail at failing is the greatest failure. Not knowing the real nature of failure, though, and the place it has in your life, a deep fear of failure takes over your thinking. Fear of failure keeps you from relationships, keeps you from stepping out into new job opportunities, removes the healthy sense of risk from your life that is so essential to your growth as a person. Nothing takes our youth away more quickly than fear of failure. Will Rogers was once asked, "What's wrong with the world anyway?" He drawled, "I don't know. Yes, it's people." People. It's true. We must be doing something wrong. I mean, cows don't stay awake at night crying over their sins. And cats, did you ever have a cat come in, slump down over the corner somewhere, look up and say, "I'm a failure. I've been out trying to catch mice today and didn't have a good day. I'm just a failure. I don't think I'll ever go out again. I'm depressed." Or a tick. Now, we don't appreciate ticks very much, and especially when they get on us. But I'll tell you, they're pretty incredible. A tick has three senses, light, temperature, and feeling. But that's enough to get them out on that limb. It's enough to tell them when a warm-blooded animal is passing beneath them. It's enough to let them know just the right moment to roll over off the limb and onto the back of the warm-blooded animal just in time for lunch. But you know, I've never seen a tick get about halfway out on that limb, come to a screeching halt, rear back on its haunches, and say, "I wonder who I am. Is my life worthwhile? Am I really doing what a tick should do?" Or think of a fish in the water. A fish in water is so free, all the resistance has been reduced. They move in a beautiful, flowing way through the water. So free, so little dissonance. But put that fish on a sandy beach and watch him. He flops obscenely. Sand gets everywhere in his eyes and his gills. He struggles for air, and you can easily imagine that in that condition, the fish might begin to wonder who he is. He probably suffers a real identity crisis. On that beach, he can't perform as a fish. He can't have relationships. He's dissatisfied. Can't fulfill the purpose of a fish. What's wrong? All his attempts to overcome specific problems, specific failures, wouldn't fully succeed. He would meet constant failure every day. Now, he could blame himself, he could blame others, he could talk about the bad breaks or the camouflaged hooks, but it would all be futile. His whole approach would be wrong. He hasn't perceived the depth of the problem. He flops, thinking he will fight the problem and win. We, because of our perspective, know better. Now, what's Fred? Incidentally, that's the name I've given my fish friend on the sandy beach. What's Fred's problem? Simply put, he's out of his element. And as long as he's out of his element, his failure will be permanent. His problems won't go away. Being out of your element means you can't become what you were meant to be. You can't fulfill the expectations of your life. You can't enjoy the relationships you long for. And you'll never have real meaning in your life. Freedom, well, that will never be more than a taunting word. Emptiness, loneliness, boredom, disappointment, these will dog your heels. Out of your element, your strenuous attempts to solve your problems will become less and less. And soon, as a fish on a bank, you will only make occasional attempts. And finally, you lie still and you wait. Is it true that we sometimes identify more with Fred the fish as he flops and struggles on the sandy bank than we do when he's in his element, the water? Do you and I as persons, do we have an element? Are we out of it? Could that be the reason our problems won't go away? If this is possible, it would help explain some things. For example, it would help explain why we fail and haven't been able to overcome it. And of course, a fish couldn't solve its problems as long as it's on the beach. He's out of his element. If you and I are out of our element as persons, failure is inevitable. And it would help explain why we sometimes feel we're strangers, that it's so hard to relate to others. Inwardly, we gasp for life, for love, and for hope. Once there was a lady who had a lot of problems. She had 12 children, and her aged parents moved into her house, and then her husband's parents moved into the little house as well. Well, the woman was in total desperation. She went to her rabbi and said, "Life's impossible with my 12 kids, my husband, my parents, his parents. I'm going crazy." The rabbi heard her story, and here's what he told her to do. He said, "Now, when you get home, I want you to go out to the barn and get the cow and bring it into the house with you, and then come back and see me in a week." A week later, the woman came back to the rabbi screaming for him to do something. "Rabbi," she said, "life's impossible with my house full of people and the cow. What am I going to do?" And the rabbi said, "You go home and you go out to the barn and get the horse and bring it into the house with you, and then come back and see me in a week." A week later, the woman came back absolutely beside herself, and the rabbi told her to go home and take the cow and the horse out of the house. A few days later, the woman came back to see the rabbi, all smiles, very serene, and said, "Rabbi, life is so wonderful without the cow and the horse." To find a solution to our problems, we have to be realistic. Our perspective must be clear. Now, you and I can get the cows and horses out of our lives if we'll be realistic about ourselves. Here's what I want you to do. First, I want you to face up to the fact of failure in your life. I want you to know you're not strange just because you fail. We're all alike in that respect. The difference at best is only one of degree. Second, I want you to sit down with a friend, maybe a member of your family. Talk this over. Ask them what they think about the nature of failure. Test these things for yourself. Third, what about this matter of element? Could persons have an element like birds have air and fish have water? Don't worry right now about all the details. Reflect now only on the possibility that what you've always hoped and dreamed, that you'd one day be in a situation where things would work out for you in a happy, fulfilling way, that just might still be possible. I know this. I know you're important, that you're worth more than all the money of the world piled together. I know nothing is as special as a person. And I know there aren't any insignificant people. I know these things, and I know they're true of you. The question is, do you know it? Hi, how's your week going? Now, if you'll remember, in Exploration 1, we talked about why our problems won't go away, and we discovered the magnitude of our problems and the sense of failure they cause in our lives. I discussed then several characteristics of failure, pointing out that failure is a part of our nature, that the way we're approaching failure, though, will bring certain defeat. What's needed is a new way to look at ourselves, which I suggested is the same as finding our element. That in our element, we find a way to deal successfully with the failures in our lives. I ask you to accept the fact of failure and to discuss these matters with a friend. What'd you find out? Aren't we on the right track? Now let's go on. Dr. Eric Byrne wrote a best-selling book called Games People Play. In Exploration 2, we will look not at games people play, but at games people lose. We hate to lose. But we do, and sometimes we lose the big ones. How many people do you know who've lost their marriages, either to divorce or to coexistence? And how many people do you know who've lost their children to drugs, cults, or their own indifference? How many people do you know who spent 20, 30, 40 years collecting houses, kids, ulcers, only to ask why? I sat on an airplane by an Air Force colonel who just retired after some 30 years with the military. He said, "Can you imagine how it feels to work 30 years for something only to arrive and find it wasn't there?" He lost the game. And Freddie Prinze at 22, famous, rich, only to get there and find that what he was looking for wasn't there. And he took his life. Lost the game. Elvis Presley. My, how much of this world's glamour, wealth, and praise he had. He still called the king, but in the end, it wasn't enough.
I think somehow that we've been led to believe that if we just play by the rules, we'll win. If we get the right education, the right marriage partner, the right job, move into the right house, and on and on and on, we'll be happy. But it just doesn't happen, does it? We put the pressure of making our life meaningful on bridges that can't bear the load. We overload our marriages with things marriage isn't for. And that's why, for many people, the game of marriage ends in divorce or coexistence. Many people try to live on an endless search for thrills, but action without meaning, it soon ceases to satisfy. We lose. We try to fill our emptiness with love, and particularly sexual love. But when you love for your own benefit, something selfish introduces itself which destroys what is of real value in the other person. No despair is greater than the despair of losing the game of love. And so we go on from power to prosperity to popularity to pleasure, greed, all in an attempt to live. Once there was a man who wanted to be a king. His name was Sidney Arthur. His only possession, a small bag of diamonds, far too little to purchase a kingdom in his own country. He had heard stories about a people called the Baskars in a faraway country who didn't know real estate values. And so Sidney took his diamonds, traveled halfway around the world to the land of the Baskars, and was brought to the chieftain. Sidney drove his bargain. In exchange for the bag of diamonds, he could have all the land he could walk around in a day. The only condition? He had to be back to the chieftain's village by sundown. That night, Sidney could hardly sleep. He was the man who would be king. The next day, he would circle an empire. His dreams would be fulfilled. Early the next morning, he arose just as the first rays of the sun began breaking over the horizon, and he began moving across the landscape in a run. He wanted to take their whole kingdom. He ran until his sides hurt. Then he ran some more. By noon, he was walking. The sun was hot. And finally, late in the afternoon, he suddenly realized he had circled and circled and circled, and now he was far away from the chieftain's village. The only way he could possibly get back by sundown was to run as hard as he could run. He started running, and he ran until he thought his heart would explode. Finally, seconds before sundown, he stumbled into the chieftain's village and fell down. He was dead. Blood was trickling out of his mouth. The chieftain took off Sidney's hat and measured off the land Sidney now needed. The distance from his head to his feet. In the end, all the land a man needs. He lost the game. Alan Harrington summarizes these losing game plans as spiritual uplift, psychiatric consultation, group action, drunkenness, embracing the outdoors, making love as often as possible to the very edge of consciousness, and forgetting about anything else, burying oneself in work, games, and large families. I think we're like the man Tolstoy tells of, who was chased by a pack of wolves. He ran and ran. They were getting nearer and nearer, and he finally stumbled onto an old abandoned well. He grabbed a small tree growing just inside the mouth of the well and lowered himself beyond the reach of the wolves. Thought he was safe until he looked down into the bottom of the well, and there was a dragon, teeth bared, saliva dripping, just waiting. And then he looked to where his little tree was growing out of the side of the well, and to his horror, a black rat and a white rat were gnawing through the small trunk. There he dangled, wolves at the top, a dragon at the bottom, and rats gnawing away at his only support. And then something caught his attention. On the leaves of his little tree were a few golden drops of honey. He leaned over and began licking those drops of honey. Now, those drops of honey symbolize all the games we play, all the ways we distract ourselves, pacify ourselves, even after we've begun to suspect that we're losing the game. Let's check in on Fred the Fish. Fred, how are you feeling today? Landon, I really don't feel very well. Well, you look a little dried out, Fred. What's the problem? Well, I'm depressed and I'm exhausted all the time. My life doesn't have much meaning. Well, Fred, why don't you get yourself a color television? Maybe that would help you. And I went out and bought him a beautiful Sony. Came back, he got in his chaise lounge, crossed his tail fins, put his other fins behind his head. I put a pair of sunglasses on him to keep the sun glare down. And he laid back and began watching television. I left. Came back in a few days, said, Fred, you doing any better? Well, Ivan, this helped for a little while, but I got depressed again. Fred, I'll tell you, why don't you join a health club? You know, get a good massage, take some steam baths. Maybe that'll help you. He went out, joined a health club, did the whole number, but found that didn't really help either. Still determined to help him, I said, well, go out and get your fins trimmed. Maybe that will help. You know, get yourself a permanent. Fred went out, got his fins all fixed up, came back and said, same problem. You know, Landon, I've tried to enjoy life, but almost nothing I do is satisfying. Nothing much really helps me. I said, well, do you have any good, solid relationships, Fred? No, I'm really quite lonely. There's no one I can really relate to, no friends. Well, I can fix that. I'll be right back. I went out and got a whole basket of fish, brought them in, put them all around Fred, and there they were, all flopping on the beach. Fred, does that make you feel better? Not really. You know, Landon, you can be in a crowd and still feel awfully lonely. He thought for a moment and then said, Landon, I think I'm dying. Is this our story? Now it is, if, like Fred, we're out of our element. All of our attempts to win, the games we play and lose, all these are attempts to pacify ourselves, distract ourselves from facing the real problem. We're looking for life. We want to live. But we're looking in the wrong way and in the wrong places. We're like the man who was found down on his hands and knees under a street light. He was frantically searching for his car keys. A police officer came over, offered help, and after a while asked him, are you sure this is a place that you lost those keys? Oh, no, said the man. I've dropped them up in that dark alley, but there's no light up there. There are a couple of things I'd like for you to do now. One, I'd like for you to look for some of the ways you or others try to use things or people to do something that they just weren't designed to do. See if you notice people taking things they feel they can control and using them to try to solve the problems they feel they can't control. Observe people who are trying to overcome their lack of peace and fulfillment by working too hard, by being too obsessed with success or whatever. I think you'll find it interesting to notice yourself and others to see why you do some of the things you do. And second, pick one of the games you play. Maybe it's your marriage. Instead of using your marriage to try to make you feel good about yourself, see how many times this week you can enjoy the company of your mate just because he or she is your companion. Maybe it's a friend of yours. You place a lot of demands, perhaps, on your friendships. You're trying to get something out of it, to cure something in you. This week, just this week, try enjoying your friends without expecting anything. Enjoy them because they're a person. Appreciate them for themselves. Ease up on the demands. And by the way, don't be too hard on yourself this week. You may not have it all together, but don't forget, no one else does either. There are no superwomen or supermen. Take courage in the fact that you're still alive and you're thinking. That will earn the respect of anyone.
Hi, how's your day? If you'll recall, in Exploration 2, we discovered that it is possible to run after a lot of things in life without ever finding real meaning. We search for peace. We try to buy it. We try to marry it. We try to power our way to it. We demand it of things, houses, lands, and friends. And yet, so often, in the end comes the realization we lost. At least we can't quite say we won. Now, how did you get along with the things I asked you to do this past week? Were you able to find examples of people using other people and things in the wrong way? For example, did you notice anyone who demanded that their friend take away their loneliness? Maybe people who put so much pressure on their friends that their friendships didn't last long. Did you notice anyone who was trying so hard to succeed in their work that they neglected their mate and children. It's strange how quickly we get drawn into these webs, thinking they will bring us success, only too late to discover that any success that came at a price that was too high to pay. And the other thing I ask you to do, did you try to spend time with your companion or friend just appreciating them, not demanding anything of them, but simply enjoying them as a person? Didn't it feel good? There's something about that experience that tells us how to win as a person. And that's what I want to talk to you about now in Exploration 3, 5 tests to find out if you're winning or losing. Now let's begin with Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown's out on the pitcher's mound. Somebody's knocked a high fly in his direction, and as the ball's coming down and he reaches out for it, he says to himself, "If I catch it, I'm a hero, but if I don't, I'm a goat." He dropped it. But there may be a significant difference between us and Charlie Brown. At least he knew he dropped the ball. The 5 tests will help you decide if you're a hero or... Test number 1. To win as a person, you must live for something that circumstances cannot destroy. I like the way George Bernard Shaw said it. People are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, make them. Now, what does this mean? This means that you don't live if only. If only I'd married someone else. If only I had a different job. If only I'd been born rich. If only I'd been handsome or beautiful. And this means you don't live as soon as I get my degree, as soon as I get the promotion, as soon as the kids leave home, as soon as I retire. This means you don't live what if. What if my marriage breaks up? What if I lose my job? What if I fail? Have you defined what you're living for? Now, if you have, is it something circumstances can't take away from you? Can you see how powerful this could be? Wouldn't you like to be living for something that was so meaningful that you could face any set of circumstances and know you'd win? If you haven't found something to live for like this, can you really say you're winning? Test number 2. To win as a person, we must be living for something death can't defeat. Let me ask you something. What's the most significant thing you've done in your life? Well, here's the way one man answered that question. In fact, he's had his answer already engraved on his tombstone, and he's had the thing erected in the cemetery. Well, after his name, it reads, Bold 300, June 12, 1962. Now, that's a perfect goal for bowling, but it's sure not much to hang a life on. If you were searching for the one thing you wanted put on your tombstone, what would you put there? Unfortunately, what most people base their life on doesn't even stand up to life, much less death. For example, I learned about a man who'd fulfilled the fantasy of just about every man I've ever known. He'd married an absolutely gorgeous woman who was fabulously wealthy, and she had so much money that he really didn't have to do anything. He could have spent the rest of his life jet-setting around the world, dinner in Rome, skiing in the Alps, playing the tables in Monte Carlo. But he became kind of restless, and he opened a boutique shop in an exclusive little shopping center. Well, he was losing $10,000 a month, but he stayed busy. And, of course, he didn't need the money. But after a year or so, losing 10 grand a month, his banker came to him and said, "Why don't you close this place down and quit throwing away your money?" The man's quiet reply came, "And then what would I do?" This man was willing to pay $10,000 a month to have something to give his life for. And for what? To keep busy. Fill up the time. Was it worth it? Is there anything death can't defeat? Isn't this at the heart of our anxiety? Everything around us is dying. Can you think of anything that won't decay or pass away? Any object? Any possession, trophy, any wealth? Is there anything that is stronger than death? Have you done anything in this past year that would even make a difference to someone 10 years from now? If not, can you really say you're winning? Test number 3.
To win as a person, we must be willing to die for what we've chosen to live for. Do you know that nothing takes more pain out of death than the satisfaction of a life well lived? We're all investing our lifetime in something. And it's pretty easy for us to invest our lives making peanut butter diamonds. I'm referring to a New York scientist who discovered that he could get peanut butter hot enough and squeeze it hard enough so that it actually became a gem-quality diamond. The only problem was it cost $3,000 to make a $300 diamond. It just wasn't worth what it cost. Are you experiencing the peanut butter diamond syndrome? You work, struggle, put in the best years of your life trying to produce something worthwhile, only to realize it wasn't worth what it cost? Maybe your compulsion with success cost you your marriage, or your pride cost you the love of your children. Is what you're investing in worth it? Sometimes our children help to bring this to our minds. They can raise some pretty tough questions, like the teenager who blurted, "Look at your life, Dad. What did you accomplish? You got a house, a couple of cars, a boat, some insurance. But is that what life's all about?" That's a pretty upsetting question, and sometimes brings an angry response. But what if you could say, "I'm glad you asked that, son. I thought you'd never get around to the question, because I want to tell you what my life's about." Could you imagine the surprise that would spread across that boy's face? But could you do it? Have you chosen something worth living for? Something so exhilarating, so essential to the meaning of life, so absorbing that your life and death took their significance from it? Now, this is not something that's reserved for world leaders or superstars. This is available for every person. Are you winning? Test number 4. To win as a person, what we've chosen to live for must enhance all the important relationships of our lives. Remember King Midas? He loved gold. He lived for gold. And when he was given one wish to ask for anything in the world, he asked for the ability to turn everything he touched to gold. He was tremendously excited. He ran down the stairs. The banister turned to pure gold. He touched a chair. Turned to gold. He opened the doors to his garden. They turned to gold. And he was bending down to turn a rose into gold when his beautiful young daughter ran up to him and kissed him on the cheek, and she turned to gold. Life became cold and lifeless and lonely for Midas. He chose to live for the wrong thing. The world is full of people who live like Midas. But is that winning as a person? When we find the thing worth living for, it will nourish and enrich all of these relationships, your personal life, your health, your marriage, your children, and you'll have sufficient time for everything that's important. Are you winning? Test number 5. To win as a person, what you've chosen to live for must guarantee constant improvement until your physical death. You see, to improve till you reach 40 is not good enough. To improve until you reach retirement, that's not good enough. A real life purpose enables you to go on improving even if you live 100 years. Why choose as your real life goal something you can do only as long as you're physically strong or relatively young? Will you cease to be a person simply because you've lost your health or business or beauty or you're getting old? You can choose something to live for that will continue to exercise your mind and spirit regardless of what's happening to you or going on around you. One of my closest friends is 93. He's still laughing and working, wrote a book at 92, and his wife, who was 88, typed it for him. They're both aware their bodies are failing, but not their lives. They're still growing, as a matter of fact. They chose something to live for that is still, at 93 and 88, it's still improving their lives. Now, by this standard, are you winning? These are the 5 tests. How did you do? I discussed these at a large university some time ago. Afterward, a professor came up to me and said, "Langdon, I flunked the test." You know, sometimes we look back on our lives and we say, if we'd only done this or that. After 40 years of marriage, Thomas Carlyle's beloved wife died. In great remorse, he wrote in his diary, "Oh, that I might have you for 5 minutes more, so that I might tell you all." For him, it was too late. But for you, it is not too late. Here's what I want you to do. Think about the 5 tests. Now,
What are the possible life purposes that meet these tests? What are the options? And if you can't think of many, don't be discouraged. Don't worry right now if you don't feel you meet these tests. As Hugh Prather wrote, "If I had only forgotten future greatness, reached out to those around me, and smelled the air, and ignored the forms and the self-styled obligations, and heard the rain on the roof, and put my arms around my wife, and it's not too late." What we're reaching for is a way not to look back on our lives with regret, nor ahead in fear, but around us with awareness and a sense of aliveness. Once there was an old rabbi who looked out onto the street, and he was looking over the marketplace, and he saw donkey carts and the dogs and the children and the buying and the selling that was going on, and he noticed his Heichel, who was down there very intently bargaining and buying and going through his various activities, and he called out, "Heichel, Heichel, have you seen the sky today?" Heichel looked somewhat puzzled, and the old man invited him up. He took him to the window and he said, "Now, Heichel, in 50 years, all that you see out there, it'll all be gone. I'll be gone. You'll be gone. And what's the use of all this running if you don't even have time to look at the sky? If you don't even know whether you're winning or losing?" So accustomed to thinking about people, ourselves included, in terms of something to be bought and sold, and yet we've all experienced the inadequacy of this approach. It doesn't quite get to what a human being's all about. Things just don't quite make it to our spirits. You can't feed your inner life on steaks and cars. And so, what possible life choices do I have then that meet the requirements of these five tests? Now that's a question we need to hang on to. And now we're ready for exploration number four. The only thing that keeps you from living. You're not going to believe what I'm going to talk about. I'm talking about death, the only thing that keeps us from living. Can you believe that? Here we are talking about how to feel good about ourselves, and I bring up death. When I said the word, you probably felt a little shortness of breath. I have a close friend who at 29 was diagnosed in advanced stages of cancer. After his many hospitalizations and treatments, which incidentally all were effective, he and I were together one day at a medical clinic. He was getting a flu shot, and the young lady behind the desk asked if he had had any serious diseases, to which he quietly replied, "Well, cancer." Her mouth dropped open, and she blurted, "Are you terminal?" And just as quickly he answered, "We all are." You know, that always bothered me a little at airports. I climb aboard a big aircraft, look up, and there written in huge letters across the building is the word, "Terminal." I usually tell people what to say to me if they come around when I'm dying, because I've noticed that people don't quite know what to say at this time, and they often wind up saying and doing all the wrong things. For example, if the patient is unconscious or in a semi-conscious state, they're apt to whisper, "Is he gone yet?" That always strikes me as a bit disconcerting. Or a person goes in where another person's about to die, and he starts telling him or her, "Now everything's going to be all right, you're going to be fine, you got to get up from there so we can go fishing." And the person dying knows for sure they're not all right, and that everything's not going to be all right, and all that talk really just isn't very helpful. And then people tend to do a lot of whispering around folks who are ill. I realize that we need to be sensitive to sound, but really, do we have to start whispering and referring to the patient in the third person as if they're already an object? Is the poor thing gone yet? How much longer do you think he has? Well, I've seen so much of this that I give people the script I want them to use when I'm dying. I just tell them, "Now, if you're around when I'm getting ready to check out, if you come into my room, just come on in. Don't tiptoe in. It's okay. Come on in. Try not to be embarrassed when you come. And don't whisper too much. I want to hear what's going on as long as I can, and my hearing may be fading a little, so speak up. And don't steal my show by getting all upset and taking attention away from me. If I'm the one doing the dying, it's my hour, and I don't want anyone upstaging me." And here's what I want you to say.
come up close to me, bend over so I can hear, speak clearly and plainly, and say something like, "Hey, bud, I love you." Then at the funeral, if you pass by to view my remains, as we put it, if you'll look closely, you just might see me give you a little wink. Now notice something. You're responding to what I'm saying right now, but do you know what you're responding to? You're responding to life. Even in a discussion of death, what we really want to know is how to live. With whatever. Hi, I hope you've had a good week. In our last discussion, we explored 5 tests to find out if we're winning or losing. How did you get along in thinking of possibilities for life that would meet these tests? They cause us to think about life in a pretty different way, don't they? We're so accustomed to thinking about people, ourselves included, in terms of something to be bought and sold. And yet we've all experienced the inadequacy of this approach. It doesn't quite get to what a human being's all about. Things just don't quite make it to our spirits. You can't feed your inner life on steaks and cars. And so, what possible life choices do I have then that meet the requirements of these 5 tests? Now that's a question we need to hang on to. And now we're ready for exploration number 4, the only thing that keeps you from living. You're not going to believe what I'm going to talk about. I'm talking about death, the only thing that keeps us from living. Can you believe that? Here we are talking about how to feel good about ourselves, and I bring up death. When I said the word, you probably felt a little shortness of breath. I have a close friend who at 29 was diagnosed in advanced stages of cancer. After his many hospitalizations and treatments, which incidentally all were effective, he and I were together one day at a medical clinic. He was getting a flu shot, and the young lady behind the desk asked if he had had any serious diseases, to which he quietly replied, "Cancer." Her mouth dropped open and she blurted, "Are you terminal?" And just as quickly he answered, "We all are." You know, that always bothered me a little at airports. I climb aboard a big aircraft, look up, and there written in huge letters across the building is the word, "Terminal." I usually tell people what to say to me if they come around when I'm dying, because I've noticed that people don't quite know what to say at this time, and they often wind up saying and doing all the wrong things. For example, if the patient is unconscious or in a semi-conscious state, they're apt to whisper, "Is he gone yet?" That always strikes me as a bit disconcerting. Or a person goes in where another person's about to die and he starts telling him or her, "Now everything's going to be all right, you're going to be fine, you got to get up from there so we can go fishing." And the person dying knows for sure they're not all right and that everything's not going to be all right. And all that talk really just isn't very helpful. And then people tend to do a lot of whispering around folks who are ill. I realize that we need to be sensitive to sound, but really, do we have to start whispering and referring to the patient in the third person as if they're already an object? Is the poor thing gone yet? How much longer do you think he has? Well, I've seen so much of this that I give people the script I want them to use when I'm dying. I just tell them, "Now, if you're around when I'm getting ready to check out, if you come into my room, just come on in. Don't tiptoe in. It's okay. Come on in. Try not to be embarrassed when you come. And don't whisper too much. I want to hear what's going on as long as I can, and my hearing may be fading a little, so speak up. And don't steal my show by getting all upset and taking attention away from me. If I'm the one doing the dying, it's my hour, and I don't want anyone upstaging me." And here's what I want you to say. Come up close to me, bend over so I can hear, speak clearly and plainly, and say something like, "Hey, bud, I love you." Then at the funeral, if you pass by to view my remains, as we put it, if you'll look closely, you just might see me give you a little wink. Now notice something. You're responding to what I'm saying right now, but do you know what you're responding to? You're responding to life. Even in a discussion of death, what we really want to know is how to live. With whatever may come our way, even death, we want to know how to live, and death interferes with that. That's why we have to talk about it. The late John Wayne of the Shooter said, The last thing a man wants to do is what he winds up doing in the end, dying. And Woody Allen remarked, "I don't mind dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." George Burns said he didn't believe in death, that it had already been tried and wasn't a big kick, that he was going to figure out some other way to get out of the world. Well, of course, we know he was kidding. Death is the brick wall we hit in our attempt to live. And that's why we fight against it, because we want to live more than anything, and death keeps us from it. That's why we must face it. We must deal with it, not because it's pleasant, but because it interferes with the thing we want to do most, live. Now, in facing this question, I don't intend to do a number on you. The fact is, I don't like death. I don't think death's got any style. Death ain't got no style. And because death ain't got no style, I don't feel very good about it, and I don't want to make you feel all that hot about it. But I'll tell you what we can do. We can get an angle on it that will help us cope with it better. Now, what do we know about the act of physical death? Let's review the facts for a moment. One, we know everything will die. Two, we know death makes a direct contribution to life. Plants and animals die to provide our food and our clothing. Without death, there would be no life. Three, we're powerless before the act of death. There's nothing we can do. And four, death raises the ultimate question of the meaning of our lives. It makes us ask what life is about, what life is for. It makes us wonder what lies beyond death. And yet, none of these facts give us the information we really need. Now, let me tell you what's made a difference in the way I feel about death. I asked myself one day, I said, "Lyndon, now what are the characteristics of death?" And I thought about it. And as I did, words like separation, emptiness, alienation, insecurity, fear, these were the ideas that came to my mind. Death does all of that. It separates us from the people we love. It empties us of life. A strange sense of alienation comes over us in the presence of death, and we're left feeling very insecure and a little frightened. And as I looked at the words, a new insight struck me. These are the very same words I keep hearing people use about their lives. They feel separated from people. They suffer from a feeling of emptiness. They're alienated. They're insecure. They're afraid. These are the things that keep us from living. They keep us from a sense of aliveness. They're a kind of death that keeps us from living right now. Someone put it, life is the living you do. Death is the living you don't do. And this helps to explain something. I've noticed that the way people feel about themselves, their lives, has almost everything to do with the way they feel about their death. If they feel good about themselves, fulfilled and satisfied about life, they feel better about dying. But if they feel bad about themselves, dissatisfied with what they've accomplished with their lives, they tend to feel worse about death. Now, here's where an exciting possibility emerges. And the reason is, we can do something about the way we feel about ourselves, which in turn will affect the way we feel about death. And so what is it about our lives that keeps us from living, from enjoying life to the full, from feeling that sense of exhilaration? What are the things that drain us of zest and cause us to shrivel up? Here I think you could list things like selfishness, and self-centeredness, jealousy, suspicion, resentfulness, hurtful words. You can't build a life out of that. And these things are so serious that they really are the death that keeps us from living. You see, to raise the question of what keeps us from living every day is to run headlong into the question of our failure. We're dealing with failure in a way that keeps us from living. It keeps us from relationships, from risking, from trying new jobs, from launching out, from loving. I repeat, the fear of failure is a kind of death that keeps you from living. Now that helps me to know that we're on exactly the right track in these explorations. We're dealing with a way to cope with this failure that keeps us from living. And if we can meet the failure that keeps us from living right now, that's the strongest approach we can take toward getting a better grip on the act of physical death. And this is what our friend Fred the Fish needs. Out of his element, the water. My, Fred is puzzled about so many things. He, on the beach, for example, how could he ever figure out what fins are for? Can't you imagine him lying there wondering, wonder what these are for? I mean, on the sandy bank. Or gills. What are gills for on the sandy bank? And I think he'd get very discouraged and mighty quickly from the failure of so much flopping around that got him exactly nowhere but a little closer to the inevitable. And unable to cope with his failure while he's still breathing, those eyes, they widen with fright. We may find ourselves in a similar predicament. We look about us, we find a situation difficult to comprehend, we don't understand why we fail so much, and we don't understand why we die, and our eyes widen as we feel the years slipping from beneath us, and we look around and fear at one another. Well, at least I hope we know now a little more about what we need. We look into the future, there's physical death. But more importantly, what we've learned is that there's a kind of death eating away at our lives right now. Now, what I want us to do in continuing exercises is to work on how we can feel good about ourselves right now. And that'll change everything. Here's what I would like for you to do. I'd like for you to sit down and see if you can list some things that you feel keep you from being really happy. Now, you may want to keep that list private, and that's fine. All that's really important is be honest with yourself, as honest as you can. And when your list is completed, I want you to sit down and I want you to look at it. And then I want you to remind yourself that no matter what you have on that list, it doesn't need to stand in the way of your feeling good about yourself. You may not know just how that can be at the moment, and that's okay. But I just want you to tell yourself that there's nothing on that list that can keep you from living a joyful life. I remember a friend I met in Africa. He told me of the death of his grandmother. For years, she hadn't felt so good about herself, but late in life, she'd found some ways of coping and had come to feel much better about herself. When she was dying, all the family was at the house. The doctor came out one day and told them to gather in the room. The end was near. He said they went in, surrounded her bed, and she opened her eyes and asked them to prop her up in the bed. And they propped her up, and then he said she summoned all her energy and strength and told them a funny joke. All of those big grandsons, the rest of the family, just collapsed in laughter, and before the laughter died, she slipped away. She had planned it that way and was able to see her plan fulfilled. Now, let me quickly add, to die right, I don't think everybody has to go out in the midst of a funny story. But I do think it suggests something very human about the way we can think about it. Nothing takes the pain out of death as much as the satisfaction of a life that's well lived. Well, how's your day gone? In the last exploration, we talked about the fact that death is the only thing that keeps us from doing the one thing we most want to do, live. Our goal, our strongest drive, is to live. Death is also an appropriate way to describe all our failures, fears, feelings of weakness and inadequacy. But on the other hand, life, now that's the way we describe our hopes and aspirations, our finest impulses, our sense of adventure, love, and dreams. We're trying to find a way to feel good about ourselves in the face of death. That is the human quest. We stand in the tension between life's startling possibilities and the futility of it all in the face of death. For thousands of years, when human beings looked death in the face, they would turn to religion for an answer. And that's what we'll get into right now in exploration number 5, Games Religion Loses. You know, in some ways, this question is as difficult as the last one, the question of death. Yet, it is too much with us to ignore. Why is this? Why is religion so much with us? It's obviously a dominant presence in the United States. In some sense, it's everywhere. It's on the street corners, on the radio and television, in newspapers, magazines, billboards. It's in homes and schools and colleges and universities and government. It forces its way into our hearts in times of crisis. In times of severe illness and disease, in time of death. It appears when we're pushed beyond our own powers, at points where we can do no more, yet more is called for. As much as we value science, the religious question still remains after science has done its best. Science brilliantly describes the how and the what. but doesn't quite get to the why. Religion grows out of our sense of inadequacy, our feeling that something's wrong, our sense of failure, our need to feel that our life is under control. Religion is the way we deal with our fears and that feeling of failure, our need to believe that our life is somehow permanent, that it counts. These are basic questions, and they remain even with those who wish the word religion could be forever purged from our speech. I mean, the questions are there, they're real, and we must address them. And the way we address them, that's what we call religion. And I think in this sense, everyone is religious. When we talked about the games people lose, those games, they had become the player's religion. Religion, you see, is what we're committed to. It's what gives significance to our lives. It's what keeps us going every day. In our particular culture, religion is mostly, though, associated with one name. And that's the name of Jesus. An overwhelming majority of American people not only believe in him, but they believe he's the Son of God. Now, because he's so closely associated with the religion around us, it's important to know how he felt about religion. Did Jesus accept anything that was called religion? Did he lend his name eagerly and willingly to any group or cult who wanted it? Was he sentimental when the question of religion came up? Was he really the Jesus gentle, meek and mild image that religion today has given him? Does learning something about the meaning of life from Jesus mean that one has to accept and defend all the religion in our culture that's associated with him? I think many today are surprised to learn how strained Jesus' relationship really was with the religion of his day. For example, I remember one evening he passed through a religious house, the temple, and was appalled at what he saw. They had turned it into a commercial business. The next morning he took a whip, passed through the middle of the temple, turned tables over, drove the merchants out. People, money, and animals went in every direction. Some were no doubt shocked. Jesus saw a completely unacceptable religious condition and acted forcefully to correct it. He was no pansy who took religion on at its very center. And on other occasions, Jesus was in the act of helping people when religious leaders would oppose him for violating some of the rules and regulations, even while he was helping people. He was never strict enough to suit them, never hard enough on people. And he spent too much time with people who weren't religious. And then, as now, religion preferred religious observance over people. Jesus strenuously opposed such a view. Jesus saw the pomposity of many of the religious leaders, and he warned the people, don't do as they do. And he saw religion giving certain ones preferred titles and separating them from others as more important, and he exposed such distinctions as being wrong. He saw religion often standing at the door with its arms crossed, forbidding the common people to enter. Religion was confined to the elite, the special class, and Jesus told the religious leaders that they compass land and sea to make a convert. And when they've made one, they leave the poor person in worse condition than they found him. Now that's pretty strong language. He saw them making money more important than spiritual matters. They lived by their gold and had become the richest business of the day. He called them fools and blind men. Branding them as hypocrites, he accused them of making religious rules and regulations more important than the greatest concerns and needs of human life, justice, mercy, and faith. In graphic portrayal, he said they strained at the fly in their soup, while at the same time not noticing that they were swallowing big old hairy camels. When no one else would lift a finger against the burdens of religion, the burdens religion had imposed, Jesus went striding in, telling them they were like a tomb, beautiful, slick in appearance, but inwardly full of dead bones. He pictured religion as spending all its time polishing the outside of cups and plates, and all the while neglecting the dried, stale food stuck all over the inside. He believed the appearance of religion was deceptive. On the outside, looked pious. Claimed a premium on spirituality, but inside, that was another matter. In summary, Jesus found the religion of his day, for the most part, a burden that was simply too heavy for most people to carry. He saw millions leaving the ranks of religion, disappointed, angry, cynical. And he put some distance, that's right, he put some distance between what he was offering people and what religion had offered. You see, the difference was, he was interested in their everyday life, their worry, their anxieties, their treatment of one another, their families, their failures, their dimmed hopes, their smashed dreams. He sensed the emptiness of human life, and he spoke words of hope that were backed by a life that rang true to what he said. He was a man of the people. No distance between him and suffering, hurting humanity. And so he called on people to accept his yoke, which he described as easy, in contrast to the yoke of religion, which was too heavy to carry. Because he was near the people, and because he exposed the failure of the religion of his day, he became a hunted man. His presence and work made the religious leaders so uncomfortable, they finally reached the point where they wanted him executed. It reminds me of a story of the missionary who went to Africa and found African women carrying huge loads of wood on their backs. Their husbands, with no more than a walking stick, walked proud and erect several yards in front of them. You see, it was considered an honor for the women to carry these heavy loads for their husbands. Well, being an enterprising missionary, he immediately saw a market for wheelbarrows. He fired a cable off to the U.S. and ordered 200 of them to be shipped immediately. When they arrived, he showed them how to load the wood in the wheelbarrows. Well, a few weeks later, he returned, and there were all the wheelbarrows parked in a neat row, unused. "Why aren't you using them?" he asked. "Well, you see, when we got the wheelbarrows loaded and all of that up on our backs, it was just too heavy." When religion becomes an additional load for people, put it down. Something's wrong. And Jesus knew it. You see, religion, like so many other things, can be no more than a game people play and lose. But what does all of this mean in terms of religion and life today? What's it have to do with feeling good about yourself? Well, for millions, religion has become a game that they tried to play and lost. This makes them feel bad about themselves. And there are some others who are still in there gamely hanging on, but inside, they fear something fatal is wrong. Is it safe to assume that Jesus would approve this condition today? Is it right to associate him with it simply because his name is worn? The problem most people today have with Jesus is a result of what religion has said about him or shown him to be rather than what he really was. Then, as now, there was a marked difference between Jesus and the common view of religion. If you forget that, you'll miss something very important. This helps us to understand a lot of things. It puts in perspective the view that people have of religion coming at them with the Bible under the arm, a gleam in the eye, that certain look on the face, cornering you as a prospect for conversion. How you feel at the moment may be of no interest to them at all. They're simply out to lay their line on people with a kind of, "You don't want to burn in hell today, do you?" line. And of course it puts you in a no-win position. It's a kind of hard sell religion that a lot of people find hard to respect, me included. The same is true with all the emphasis on money in the religious world today. One mainline church has estimated holdings that would rank it among the top 50 corporations of the nation, those with total assets of $2 billion or more. The religious world, you see, has become most skilled in the art of raising money. Radio and television religion has become one of the richest and biggest businesses of our day. And I think increasing numbers of people are feeling that the church has gone off and left them. Its message has become less meaningful and helpful. A certain distance has arisen between where you are and where your church is. And to say anything is apt to bring suspicion, even exclusion. The one thing no one is to do is to point out the failure of religion. Well, Jesus didn't share this view, obviously. You know, a recent Gallup poll indicated that over 61 million Americans, 41% of the population 18 years or older, have not been to church in the last 6 months, at least not over once. These people, when questioned, said they believed most churches and synagogues had lost the real spiritual part of religion, had become too concerned with organization, were not effective in helping people find the meaning of life, and were not warm and accepting of outsiders. There was a lighthouse on the shore across from a very dangerous reef. But in spite of the lighthouse, at night, people in the lighthouse would be awakened by the sound of ships crashing on the reefs. They would jump in their lifeboats, rush out into the sea, and risking their lives would rescue the people, bringing them to shore. But as time passed, things changed. They began more and more to ignore the shrieks and cries of those in need. They turned the light inward and eventually made of the lighthouse an exclusive club. The lighthouse had retained its form and shape, but had long since lost its purpose. Does this describe what has happened to much of religion today? summing up, we still have certain fundamental needs, certain religious needs. For example, we still need a way to handle our failure, our insecurity, our fear. And we still need guidance in finding the meaning of life that will make our days bright in spite of the circumstances we face. And we need hope and love. We need something to be committed to. We want our lives to be productive. Religion, generally speaking, may or may not address these needs. You may find, however, that Jesus still speaks to these needs. You may find a difference between your experience with religion and the person of Jesus. What Jesus says about human life and what's important to human life makes a lot of sense to me. In fact, that's why I believe in God. And it's why I'm involved with people. It's why I do the workshops and courses on feeling good about yourself. I've found a way to have my deepest needs of life met that has made a real difference in the way I view you and others, in the way I live every day. My faith makes sense, but only in terms of everyday life. My religion and my life are finally one thing. Now, these are things that each person must decide for him or herself. You'll have to look at your own life. You'll have to respond to your own needs. And right now, all I'm doing is simply laying out the issues that I believe are necessary for us to think through if we're to feel good about ourselves. And I'm going to continue to share just what I've seen and heard. I have no designs or expectations to impose. My desire is to lay out the issues as clearly as I can for us to consider. And then you're a free person, and you're able to make certain decisions that affect your life for yourself. This is the respect I believe human beings must always have for each other. You may decide that religion should have no place in your life. Whatever you decide, just be sure it's based on solid information. Well-intentioned decisions based on bad or insufficient information, they can be fatal. The point to remember is, your life is important. And it's important most of all to you. Others can't make the most critical decisions for you. Each of us, finally, must assume responsibility for our own life. And that's why we need all the information we can get to base these important decisions on. Most of us will make the right decisions if we just get the right information. Sit down with a friend this week. Continue to talk about your life, what it means, and why it's important, and where it's headed. You can think about these things. They'll excite you. I believe they'll give you new courage, and you'll make good decisions. You can act, and you can act now. Hi, I hope you're feeling good about yourself today. We just completed thinking through two of the most difficult questions we face, death and religion. To feel good about ourselves, we have to face these questions and make some rational decisions about them. I hope you've had some time to think on your own about these questions. With a little time, we sometimes amaze ourselves at how clearly we can think through difficult matters. As is becoming clearer, what we're facing is a new way of looking at things. You're engaged in some thinking that can give you a different perspective on living. We're learning a new way to think about people, and that's exploration number 6, the one we're looking at now. I think sometimes we get so enmeshed in the web of living that we feel we can never, ever quite be free again. So many things around us need changing that we're sure we will never get to it all, and we're probably right. But what if you could get a new way to look at yourself, a way that would make you feel better about yourself every day? If you felt better, wouldn't that make a difference in everything around you? Let's explore this possibility, a new way to think about people. Have you ever been chosen last? I remember back when I was in school, an old boy named Ross Burks, who gave me a different view of myself. At recess, we would go out and choose up sides. I was skinny, and because I was skinny, I would often be chosen last. I'd stand there, listen as they called all the other kids' names, and then finally, at the very end, one of them might call my name. But there was one old boy, this Ross Burks, toughest kid in school, who for some reason liked me. And when he was the captain, as he often was, guess who he'd choose first? He'd choose me. And when he would choose me, the other kids would snicker until he put that evil glare on them, and of course that quieted things down. I would go over and take my place by Ross, and somehow it made me feel so good. Made me work harder when I was up to bat, made me try harder than ever to hit the ball. He'd given me a new way to look at myself. Left to our own point of view, when we look into the mirror, you know what we often see? Failure. Failure that we haven't been able to program out of our lives. Perhaps we haven't found something to live for that's exciting enough either to live or die for. And we struggle with our relationships when one is strong, another breaks apart. We find it difficult to establish the right balance in our work, our families, play, and health. And as we grow older, we see ourselves weakening. We fight it, but we still lose the battle, and if we're not careful, we begin to regress into self-pity and complaining. Loneliness creeps in. No one seems to care for us quite enough. Is there another way to view our lives? Well, philosophers, psychologists, and sociologists, and others have all worked on this problem, and they've all made certain contributions. But what I'm going to tell you today may surprise you, because it's going to come unexpectedly. After wading through a lot of ideas, I've found that what Jesus said about persons was the most succinct, insightful information that I've ever read. Because he has been drawn so deeply, though, into the institutions of religion, I think a lot of the simple and profound things he said about how to be a person have almost been completely lost. Now, if you happen to have some strong feelings against religion, I hope you won't let that get in the way. Because he had a totally unique way of looking at people. But more importantly, he was very successful in giving people a new way to look at themselves. In fact, so new, it often changed their whole approach to the way they were living. I think the way he affected people reminds me of the story of the king tiger and the orphan tiger. A baby tiger was lost from his parents, and a herd of goats adopted the orphan tiger, took him in, and cared for him. He grew up with the goats. And he adopted some of their ways. He ate grass, he tried to bleat, he thought of himself as a goat. But one day, an old tiger wandered into their midst. All the goats ran off, so frightened, and the young tiger, he himself, looked strangely at the old tiger, afraid, but somehow not afraid. And the old tiger was shocked to see the young tiger behaving in a way so unbecoming of a tiger. He slowly approached the younger one. The younger one didn't seem to understand, and yet he was strangely affected. So the old one took him down to the lake and showed him his image in the water. The young tiger stared into the water, still didn't understand. The old one tried to teach him, but to no avail. Finally, the young tiger was given a piece of raw meat. He began to eat, at first timidly, and then eagerly, and his tail began to wag, and he began to paw the ground, and then he raised his head and finally let forth a mighty roar. The young tiger had a new view of himself. I think human beings are not living in this world the way they were meant to live. We consume thousands of things that never really satisfy us. We make feeble bleating noises in our conversations with each other, but deep down in us, there's a roar waiting to be unleashed. Could it be that Jesus was a tiger who wanted to show us that we, too, were meant to be tigers instead of goats? Could it be that in looking at this man, we could suddenly realize what a human being really looks like? He encountered people who were just going through the motions of living, not really alive. And when they met him, they met a man who was totally alive. Nothing escaped him, not even short people. One day he was walking along. A large crowd was around him that made it difficult for people even to get a glimpse of him. But there was one man, very short, who was determined to see him. In a lot of ways, you wouldn't have expected this particular man to be this eager to see Jesus, because here was a man who, in a way, represented organized crime. He was known for his shady dealings, his theft, his greed, Others didn't think well of him, and he probably didn't feel all that good about himself, with his short stature and all. Still, he was so eager to see Jesus that he climbed a sycamore tree, found him a good limb, and sat down. Soon the crowd appeared, and there in the middle was the man he'd heard so much about. And suddenly, he received the shock of his life. The famous man, Jesus, was calling him to come down so he could go home with him and have lunch. My, Zacchaeus burned bark all the way to the ground, ran to Jesus, showed him the way to his house, and after a meal and some conversation, Zacchaeus threw open the doors to his house and announced to the startled crowd that lingered outside, "I'll never be the same again. This man has given me a completely new point of view. I'll never treat people the same ever again." Jesus knew what a person needs, and that's what he gave Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus had never felt so good about himself, clean for the first time in years. On another occasion, Jesus saw a group of men coming toward him, and as they got closer, he realized they were dragging something. They came nearer and then threw a woman at his feet. She lay there in the dust, sobbing quietly. The men said, "We've caught this woman in the very act of adultery. The law says stone her. What do you say?" Jesus looked at her, looked at the men, and he said in essence, "You're right. The law does say that. And if there's any one of you who's never committed a wrong, you have my permission to pick up the first stone and kill the woman." He knelt at that point and began to write on the ground. A few moments later, he looked up and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers?" She said, "They're gone." Jesus looked at her. She could hardly look him in the eye. She had always been taken for granted, used, and abused. She'd had a lot of sex, but had never known love. She was lonely, and she faced a future filled with loneliness, poor self-image. And others, they saw her as hopeless. In their eyes, she was just no good. Anyone could tell that by looking at her. They had locked her into a life of failure. She was a prostitute. She would never change. They were sure of that. And if you were nice to her today, tonight she would be right back on the streets. She was just no good. Well, Jesus looked at her in a new way, and in effect, he said to her, "I don't share people's view that you're no good. I see something in you worthwhile, even though you've made a lot of mistakes. I don't think you were made to be a prostitute. I don't think you'll continue that kind of life. I believe in you. I believe you can and will live in a different way. And so I want you to go now and live in a new and meaningful way." I can just see her. She takes a few steps, turns back, a few more steps, turns again, and she knew in her heart that she'd never, ever be quite the same. She felt good inside. Her world suddenly was set in a brand new frame. Now Jesus tells about a man who had two sons. The younger was a little impatient and said, "Father, I want you to give me my inheritance." Well, the father gave him his living, Jesus said. And he went into a far country, and there he wasted everything. Ran with the wrong kinds of crowds, did the wrong kinds of things. Oh, he had lots of friends, as long as the money lasted. But the time came when the money was gone. And when the money was gone, the friends were gone. And the young man found himself alone and hungry, had a hard time getting a job. Finally, he forced himself onto one of the citizens of the country, who gave him a job feeding swine. You can imagine how humiliating that was, a young Jewish man feeding pigs. But something happened to him. While feeding the pigs one day, so hungry he would have been glad to eat the food he was giving them, he came to himself. And he said, "The servants in my father's house, they have more than I have here. I'm not worthy any longer to be a son, but I'm going to go back home and I'm going to find my father. And I'm going to simply say, 'Father, I don't deserve to be called your son. But would you make me a hired servant?'" And Jesus said he arose and started home. You know, it's hard for us to imagine the courage this took. I guess one of the hardest things in the world is for a son or daughter to admit they've made a big mistake. It's hardest to approach those we love the most. Family failure, that's some of the worst failure there is. And children feel it in an especially keen way. Now, what does this boy need? How will his father view him? We know how many fathers would look at him. The attitude would be, "I knew he'd come crawling back. I may let him come back home, but he'll have to prove himself." And the son would be made to feel pretty rotten about the whole thing, and then probably be reminded of it over and over for years to come. Let's see what happened. You can just imagine. The closer he came to home, the faster he walked. And then Jesus said, you know what happened? The father He'd been waiting for him, perhaps every day. He'd gone to that window. The servants had watched him. They knew that in his heart he was reaching out for his boy. And then one day, as the father looked down that trail, he saw a familiar scene. It was unmistakable. It was his son's walk. And he goes tearing out of the house and starts running toward the son. The son looks up, sees his father, and he too begins to run. Son running to father, father to son. And finally the distance closed, and they collapsed into each other's arms. The young son was trying to say, "Father, don't call me a son, I'm not worthy anymore." But the father's words drowned them out as he said, "My son, my son, bring the robe, kill the fatted calf, let's throw a big party. This my son was dead, but he's alive. He was lost, but he's found." And he would hear nothing of the boy's desire simply to be a servant. The young man, well, he could never be the same again. After days and days of feeling bad about himself, all that changed. And then I remember another time. He was walking along, and he looked over, and he saw a tax desk, and behind it, a man named Matthew. Now, Matthew collected taxes, and of course, everybody hated tax collectors. But again, Jesus saw that man in a different way. Now, Matthew may have been one of those who felt trapped in a dead-end job. I mean, he received no thanks for what he did, that was for sure. And he was often the object of scorn and hostility from others. But he didn't know any way out. And then that day, this strange man said, "Matthew, I want you to follow me." You can almost see Matthew as he looks up, and at first, for a fleeting moment, there's a, "Me? Are you sure you have the right man?" But as he looked into Jesus' eyes, there was no doubt. Jesus knew exactly what he was doing. He had the right man. Matthew came, and he followed him. The dull routine of life was broken by the interest Jesus took in him. He got a new point of view for his life, felt better about himself than he ever had. Late one night, a leader in organized religion hunted him out. He was a very religious man, and because of that, everyone looked to him for the answers. And because of this expectation, though, he couldn't tell anyone how he really felt. He couldn't tell them that he wasn't sure of himself anymore, that something was missing in his own religious life. And he felt bad about continuing in his role, but didn't know any respectable way to stop. He decided to risk seeing Jesus privately. He believed he could trust him and speak with him confidentially. When he approached Jesus, he acknowledged that he saw in him something special. He was having an impact on people's lives in a way that Nicodemus had not seen before. Jesus knew what he was saying, and he knew how he felt, the load he was carrying. He understood what it was like to feel trapped by your own religious commitments and responsibilities. And he knew how difficult it would be for Nicodemus to change, how much pressure would be on him. But still, he gave to Nicodemus a completely, totally different possibility for his life. He told him there was no cosmetic change that would help him. The only thing that would help would be to start over again. And that's what he told him. For months, Nicodemus thought about what Jesus had said to him. And the more he thought about it, the more sense it made. And he finally decided to act on it. And his life took on a courage he had never known. Now, I don't think that for these people everything was rosy after this. I think they still had to face difficult situations, still struggled with themselves. But the difference was in the way they could now feel about themselves. What is this new way to look at people? Well, first, we must view a person as the most important thing in the world. There are no insignificant people. Everyone has real value. And second, people will respond when you're honest with them while expressing confidence and hope in what they are and what they can be. Third, it is of little help to persons to be reminded over and over of their failures. What we need is to know someone who believes our failure is not final, that the worst situations can be reversed, that no matter what I've done, my life can still be worthwhile and productive. Fourth, people need to be forgiven. We can't undo so many of the failures of our lives. We're too complex. As an example, I see parents who've lost their children, some to cults and drugs or bizarre religions or sometimes to a life of miserable failure. And the parents blame themselves, and they think back on all that they perhaps could have done, and they live with guilt. And they don't know that even failure there, it can be forgiven. In fact, the greatest hope lies there. If any possibility remains for the parents to have the child again, it will happen only if the parent is forgiven, So he or she is able to approach the child with a different attitude, a different hope, a different brightness. Fifth, persons, all persons, need acceptance. This is the way we all need to be looked at. We're acceptable. In spite of what we've done, we're acceptable to others. The feelings of judgment and rejection, those are difficult to live with, and I know we can't grow in a hostile, condemning environment. Persons need an atmosphere of acceptance. Now, these are some of the ways Jesus viewed the people we've talked about. I think that's why it was effective. Why don't you place some of these things in your mind today and try to view the people around you this way, and don't make any exceptions. Now, it'll be hard for you, but you'll do it, and it'll do strange things to you in the way you think. Work with it all this week. The basic thing is, don't forget that a person, including you, is the most important thing in the world, that we've all failed, but we're all still valuable. Roll out the red carpet for the people around you this week. Shower the people you love with love.